John Jones for the appellate, L. Stephen Emmer for the appellate.
You may proceed. Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, I am John Jones on behalf of the Commonwealth. At this time, I'd like to ask if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. All right. Thank you, Your Honor. So there are two essential questions that I think that are asked in this appeal. The first is whether the Circuit Court erred in finding that Rawls and Grafmuller had overruled Royster and Smith. I believe the answer to that question is that it definitely did err in that respect. I think I anticipate that a follow-up question may be whether the Court should take the opportunity now to make our law uniform and to go ahead and overrule Royster and Smith, or whether those cases should be preserved in their effect. And I believe that they do, that principle that's enunciated in those cases has continued vitality and importance today, and I'll explain why. The stare decisis bound the Circuit Court to find that inadequate sentences are not void in the same manner that excessive sentences are. Rawls and Grafmuller did not purport to and did not effectively overrule Royster or Smith. In the issue in Rawls and Grafmuller, and so Rawls and Grafmuller, and I think I briefed this aspect of it adequately, they dealt with excessive sentences, but they did not deal with how to identify a void order. They were essentially remedies cases. The question that was presented in both of them is, once you have an order that everybody agrees is void for exceeding the statutory maximum, what do you do about it? Is the defendant entitled to a new sentencing hearing, or can the court just lop off the excess, essentially, and impose a sentence that is statutorily acceptable? And Rawls, the bright line rule that was established in Rawls, you know, first Rawls went through and examined the court's jurisprudence on that particular remedies question, and the court, you know, had acknowledged that its jurisprudence was not consistent on that point. There were some instances in which it had given its imprimatur to courts just taking the excess off and leaving them with what was left, and there were other cases where the court had ordered a new sentencing hearing. And the bright line rule that was established by Rawls was that if you have a sentence that is void for exceeding, and I know the language of the opinion says violating, but the facts dictate that it was exceeding the statutory maximum, then that defendant is entitled to a new sentencing hearing. The issue in Grafmuller was whether that rule applied in a bench trial, because Rawls had come up in the context of a jury trial, and a good part of the analysis hinged on the fact that the court's taking just a 5 years off of the 25-year sentence speculated that the jury would have done the same, when the jury had in fact sentenced Rawls to approximately 5/8 of his what they thought was his exposure. And the court said, no, he is entitled to have a jury determine, in light of the correct sentencing instruction, whether they want to give him 5/8 of 20 years or all of 20 years. And so a new sentencing hearing is necessary.
How would it work here if we agreed, yeah, you've got to get back in the range? Would we just order it to the bottom of the range, or would we order a new sentencing hearing and he may get many, many more years than the minimum?
So my understanding of the state of the law currently, and I know that this has been an issue of some back and forth, is that the mandatory minimum on these particular offenses is also the mandatory maximum.
So it would just be imposing that one number on the defendant.
If the court finds that these are void ab initio and reverses them, then it would be imposing that number on
them. What would we do in cases where there's a statutory range and there's no, and we haven't interpreted the word minimum to mean maximum?
In those cases, I believe that the correct remedy would be to remand for a new sentencing hearing, again, if the court finds that inadequate sentences are void ab initio. So,
I'm trying to figure out a way conceptually to draw the distinction. And I know you, for example, in your brief, you point out, well, in one instance, the Commonwealth can appeal, and so therefore that's the answer there. But what would be the basis to say, well, if it's void in one direction, it's not void in the other direction?
So my most straightforward answer to that is that one is a manifest injustice. When you have a sentence that's over the statutory maximum, the defendant is suffering a manifest injustice in excess of what the General Assembly has authorized. When you have an inadequate sentence, that's a windfall to the defendant. The Commonwealth does have an opportunity to challenge that, and I guess that a defendant, if they wanted to, could.
Right, but the defendant has opportunity to challenge it as well, right? I mean, he has a direct appeal, same as the Commonwealth.
Yes, Your Honor.
So there's symmetry there.
Yes. Well, the our position is not that inadequate sentences are good. Our position is that Rule 1-1, and this court has talked a lot about how it's rigorously enforced, and that absent a well-established exception.
There is a thread that appears in disparate context, but one example, for example, is the rule of lenity, where we say, well, look, if you have statutory ambiguity, our system puts a thumb on the scale of liberty.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so we're going to interpret that in the defendant's favor. It's a very different context, but there is that thread in a number of areas where we say we put a thumb on the scale for liberty, and so might this be another one of those instances where, look, you know, the government's bringing its full weight to bear on someone, and if there's an excess, then that principle applies and allows a defendant to file a motion to vacate and have a correct sentence imposed, but it doesn't work in the other direction because that principle doesn't apply when it's the Commonwealth not having the full sentence imposed. I'm just thinking if that's a plausible line
to
distinguish between the two.
Counsel,
may not be. I don't know.
If I could respond, just as a matter of first principles, there are other instances. The presumption of innocence is one such, and the burden of proof to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And it's been said many times that we'd rather 100 guilty men walk free than one innocent be incarcerated. And so I think that this is perhaps a corollary to that principle.
Counsel, this has been fascinating. I feel like I'm listening to two scholars, each of whom has a glass of Cavassier or something, sitting by a fire. I think it's simpler than that. We have to obey the statute. And if the statute says 5 years and you give 7, it's got to go back. If the statute says 5 years and you give 3, it's got to go back. The statute rules. Does it get any simpler, any more complicated than that?
That is the simplest rule, Your Honor. But that has not been the rule of the Commonwealth in the past, as Smith and Royster bear out. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a principled reason to make a distinction in treatment there. There are significant costs to exempting any class of orders from Rule 1-1. And I think that it's difficult to predict the impact of announcing a new rule on this point. But I would
love it if our rules trumped statute, but I just don't know that they do.
Well, Your Honor, I mean, and again, the Commonwealth isn't saying that this is that inadequate sentences are good. And if this had come up on direct appeal, then it would certainly be reversible. But the general rule is that even errant judgments, even judgments that violate the law, finality attaches to those after a certain point, unless they suffer from a defect that renders them void ab initio.
We've carved out a limited exception for sentences in excess. But for suppose, I mean, there's a cap on punitive damages on the civil side. So suppose someone, it's just an error, but awards punitive damages, or a Med-Mal case, damages in excess of the cap there. So are we going to say, well, statute governs, and so therefore you can file a motion to vacate 10 years after the fact and get it shaved back? Well, we've said that with a sentence potentially in excess. We haven't applied that principle ever. So I'm just trying to figure out there has to be some limit, because otherwise We'd just point to the statute, and there would be no finality whatsoever.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that principles of finality and just, you know, the consistent administration of law requires for people to be able to depend on judgments. And in this context, it's a sentencing order. You know, it's kind of a big deal. And this isn't a particularly rare type of challenge. You know, actually, probably illustrative of that point is that Smith and Royster came up in this exact same context. Mr. Smith was sentenced to two inadequate sentences. He had a third sentence from a separate court. He was serving out his time at the State Farm Penitentiary, or correctional facility. And he got the idea, and if you read Royster, you know, he filed for habeas relief saying, hey, I got inadequate sentences, and, you know, as a result, I've served out all my time on this third sentence, and I need to be released. And he succeeded in getting habeas relief. But then the circuit court sent him back to Page County, and he got resentenced, and the Commonwealth's attorney, you know, went for the full freight. And so he wound up with more time than he had started with. And it came up here, and that, you know, that was in Smith versus Commonwealth. This court said, you know, no, that imposition of the new sentence was improper because that wasn't a void sentence. It was merely voidable, and nobody challenged it in time. And in Royster, that was the habeas side of it, said, no, you don't get to challenge these because they were merely voidable. They weren't void ab initio. And so we see it also in the context, just anecdotally, of when courts fail to properly sentence people to post-release supervision. There's a very common form of void ab initio challenge that currently where we'll say, no, that's not void ab initio, that's voidable, and it wasn't challenged, and you actually got a benefit. So, you know, finality attaches there. But, you know, if the court finds that any deviation from the sentencing requirements is challengeable forever, literally, then it's just hard to foresee what cost that will bring, but they're significant. Another
counsel,
instance...
It seemed to me, and perhaps I overread it, and the motion to reconsider, Mr. Watson argues that he is not just entitled to resentencing, but that because his plea was not voluntarily and knowingly entered, and could not have been voluntarily and knowingly entered because everyone thought it was 3 as opposed to 5, that he should be allowed to withdraw his plea and have a new trial. Is that the argument, as I understand it, and what's the Commonwealth's position?
The Commonwealth's position is that that's not before this court on appeal. If it were, that's a thorny question.
Why is it not before us? It was in his motion to reconsider, I thought.
But it's not part of... I don't think that he's raised it in his side of the cross appeal, and it's certainly, you know, we're not raising that.
Okay.
And I think under Graves, the proper remedy is just to impose the mandatory sentence if the court finds it's void ab initio. I know I'm cutting into my rebuttal, but one more point I just wanted to make is that in the context, you know, this is coming up in a negotiated guilty plea, and so resentencing is pretty simple if this were to be found void ab initio. But in the context of a jury trial, you know, where witnesses may be dead years after the fact, and the more serious the crime and the longer the sentence, the worse the impact of this would be as far as litigation costs go for the Commonwealth and the trial courts. You know, allowing defendants to then collaterally attack those judgments years after the fact, you know, there has to be a manifest injustice to justify that. And so excessive sentences, we allow that. Inadequate, we don't. And if the court's willing, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
You have 1 minute and 15 seconds left.
So you get the easy argument, she gets the hard one?
I gave her first choice. I literally did. Good morning. I'm Steve Emmert, and thank you for giving us this opportunity to address this. In the Graf-Miller decision, the court stated in its opinion, despite the clarity of our holding and roles, we're now invited to create an exception. I think I'm correct in detecting at least a tincture of irritation at issue this what the court called a bright line rule, purposefully broad, and that someone yet wants to create an exception. This is another such case.
Does he get a right to contest his guilty plea years after a final judgment?
You're asking again a question I agree with Mr. Jones is not before the court at this point.
Well, under your logic, whether it were or weren't before the court, would you be able to do that?
I want to make sure that I understand the nature of your question. Would he be able to challenge his
conviction? Is void ab initio, as you say.
Yes.
Would it be the next case 3 years from now, the integrity of the court would be on the line if we did not allow him, supposedly, did not allow him the opportunity to withdraw a guilty plea that he'd made in an earlier case? Collaterally allow him to do it.
Now, again, you're asking me to project beyond this to an issue that is not before the court. I'm hesitant to do that.
Well, careful with dicta is to find out where it's going to go, because none of us could have expected the argument today.
Well, I didn't expect it either. When I first looked at this, it came as a surprise to me as well.
So the question is, under your logic, if your theory of the law were right, in a case where someone says, look, it's void ab initio, I want to go back for resentencing, and I get a right to withdraw my guilty plea, would he or would he not, under your understanding of the law?
I think the answer to that is yes. But in truth, it's up to the sentencing judge to decide that. I agree with Mr. Jones that whether he can withdraw his guilty plea and proceed further is not before the court in this proceeding. But your case law seems to indicate that the case goes back for resentencing, at which point the trial court now has control over the case.
Guilty plea is guilt or innocence, has nothing whatsoever to do with sentencing.
I agree with you. But the court now has control over the case. The trial judge has the ability to. Every other order is interlocutory at that point once the court has had the case back and it's no longer a final order deciding the case.
So in Graves, if we send the cases back, the manifest injustice cases that are over the range, trial judges can say, you know what, they told me to reduce the sentence. I think I'm just going to vacate the whole thing and send it to a second trial 15 years after the case where there's no witnesses, the victim's come and gone. The court would have the authority to do that?
I think the court would have the power to do it. I seriously doubt that any court would do that. You're asking, in a theoretical world, could that possibly be happening? Yes, I think it could. I just don't think that it's within the realm of reality that a court would do that.
In a theoretical world, it's quite hard for me, Mr. Emmert, to suppose that a defendant would come before the court and ask for a higher sentence.
I understand that. That's the case. It surprised me as well when I first read it.
I really wonder about some of the collateral consequences of that, quite frankly. Maybe the next filing is going to be a habeas corpus action for presenting such an argument.
I can't theorize on that, Your Honor. I don't know how to answer the question that you have because I don't know what consequences that you have in mind. What I do know is that the language of Rawls was clear. You didn't say sentences beyond a statutory maximum are void. You said sentences outside a statutory range are void. And the reason for that, as you expressed in Rawls and again in Graffmuller, is that the court doesn't have the power to enter that order. It is very much a limitation.
What about my spillover scenario with, for instance, a cap on punitive damages or just a mistake? A party gets an excess of that or a med mal case. Wouldn't the exact same construct apply where someone could file a motion to vacate and say, hey, hang on, nobody caught this at the time, but now I want to vacate these civil judgments? What would be the difference between we've got to follow the statute in sentencing context, and same thing on the civil side?
The best answer I can give you standing here on my feet is that it probably doesn't apply to the court's power to enter an order like that. That's an error. That's a legal error.
Oh, okay.
That's my view of it. Now, this is not something I've even considered in the civil context, so I didn't prepare for that aspect of the case in preparing.
But, I mean, the argument is statute says here's your ceiling. You went above that. We're going to pare it back, or you went below the ceiling, we're going to raise it up, because you didn't follow the statute. Well, we have all these other statutes, volumes and volumes of these statutes, and if the idea is you didn't follow them, therefore it's void, therefore we're going to have a do-over, finality is just going out the window.
I don't think it's quite that Armageddon-like in this case. Perhaps the answer is in the Jones case, which I reviewed in order to prepare for this argument today, where which the Commonwealth cited. And there are three sentences there that may address this, but I think also compel an affirmance in this case if you adhere to those. The first is, and these are 293 Virginia at page 49, where you'll find these sentences. The first is, there's no inherent judicial power to fix terms of imprisonment. The second is, a Virginia trial court has no inherent authority to depart from the range of punishment legislatively prescribed. And the final one that does compel affirmance again, if you choose to adhere to that, is When a court imposes a sentence outside the range set by the legislature, the sentencing order, at least to that extent, is void ab initio because the court has no jurisdiction to do so.
But the court has no inherent authority to violate the Confrontation Clause of the Sixth Amendment, no inherent authority to violate the Warrant Clause of the Fifth Amendment, or dozens of other constitutional rules. And every one of them is subject to finality but for the collateral attack of habeas. So you can't file a motion to vacate 20 years after the fact saying the trial judge had no authority to deny me my Confrontation Clause rights under Crawford. We would say, sorry, that's over. You should have appealed it.
I understand that, and I recognize the passage from Jones in which the court laid out that those rights can be waived. But the court has said in Rawls that this is a void ab initio ruling. This is not something subject to waiver. This is not something that is voidable. You've said in Rawls and again in Graf-Muller, and again as recently as 3 weeks ago in the Cox case, that when the court does something that it specifically does not have the power to do, that it doesn't have the authority to do, that, in the words of Jones, it doesn't have the jurisdiction to do, then that is void. As Ms. Porto correctly pointed out, it's a fiction. And we're adhering to a fiction? That's not what the court's doctrine has laid out as the proper course of action.
But
he has the right to
challenge. Have we ever held a sentence below the minimum is void of an issue? Have we ever once held that? Not the statements of dicta, because we have dicta in this case going back and forth on both sides of the debate. So we've never held it, and holdings are what make stare decisis.
I understand that, and perhaps unsurprisingly, I've found none. I have not found another criminal defendant who has attacked the sufficiency of his sentence as opposed to the excessiveness.
Yeah, why would a defendant do that?
I'm going to give you the same answer that Ms. Porto gave under Rule 1.6. I'm not at liberty to answer that question, Your Honor. I apologize. But what it means is, if you're going to hold that this kind of an action outside the court's authority to act is nevertheless merely voidable, that it's waivable, then you must erase Rawls. You must wipe Graf-Muller off the pages of Virginia Reports, because there's no way to square those holdings with what the Commonwealth is asking you to do here. They're asking you, just as in Graf-Muller, to create an exception to a clearly stated, bright line, purposefully broad rule. I sense that you may have something that I'm maybe holding you up from asking, Your Honor.
I was, but continue.
Okay. All right. But in this case, I want to go back to the language that you've always used in your rulings, that it's not above a statutory maximum. You've always said outside a range. And if the court had really meant to say anything above the maximum, you would have said that. You've said it at least once.
I don't know that anyone anticipated this distinct scenario. That's why I think it was stated the way it was, to anticipate in light of what was in front of the court and what could fairly be anticipated to come before the court later.
I'm not in a position to say what was in your minds when you issued these rulings, and perhaps nobody did anticipate that.
I don't know that we collectively anticipated this moment.
I finished law school in 1982, and I didn't foresee this either, so this is probably a new experience for most of us.
So under your theory, a prosecutor who wants to play a little bit fast and loose makes a deal, enters into a plea agreement, gets a sentence below the range because he's got some interest group he's trying to please for his next election. 5 years later, the law and order prosecutor shows up, kicks him out of office, takes over the dockets, and says, you know what, I'm going to take all those earlier deals that were made, and I'm going to make my name, which is I'm the tough guy, and I'm going to vacate all those things and add 2 years here, and 3 years here, and 4 years here. That's okay with you?
It's not whether it's okay with me, it's whether it's okay with the rulings in all these cases that you have handed down. Strictly speaking, the answer is, yes, it's consistent with Rawls. Yes, it's consistent with Graf-Muller.
And you think that's what we meant to do?
Again, I can't tell you what you meant to do. All I know is what you said, and you spoke in unmistakable language. The court's purpose in Rawls was specifically to reconcile a bunch of inconsistent holdings. And I submit that two of those were Royster and Smith from the 1950s, because I won't say you're all over the place, because not even you said that. But the point is that it was not possible to reconcile them exactly. And so the court specifically set out to create a rule. And the rule that you created was specifically phrased in a way that this case, when applied to it, calls for affirmance.
We certainly can't fault you for our language, but you recognize that what you're asking could mean that someone who has been released would now have the sheriff at their door tomorrow picking them up and saying, oh, by the way, you've got two more years to serve.
I think that's conceivable. Again, I don't know that it's very likely, because once that someone's been released, I doubt that there will be much interest in hauling him back in on a charge like this. This is not, we're talking about a murder
until
charge.
Mr. Watson finds out about it.
The court continues to attach a maleficent intent on Mr. Watson's part. The limited part I can tell you is he has no such intent.
Okay, all right.
This is not based upon people that he made enemies with in the canteen.
He has a surpassing interest in the jurisprudence of the common.
But I think
that was nice to say.
But I think Justice McCullough makes a good point, because if it's not Mr. Watson, it could just be the busybody lady down the street who's tired of looking at Oprah, so she just goes through past convictions to see if anybody got a conviction less than the mandatory amount and tells the court about it.
That too is something that theoretically I suppose you could have. You could have Mr. or Ms. Busybody looking around and scouring the records to see if you can find something that's inappropriate. But the point is, we have your case law to interpret here, to apply here. I won't even say interpret, because the language is clear. And when you apply the language that is clear, that is unmistakable, no one has suggested that it's ambiguous, then the answer is that this case should be affirmed. Mr. Watson has a right to have exactly what the trial court ordered, to go back for a new sentencing. What happens in that is up to the trial judge. But he has that right. Unless you're going to abandon the rulings that you've clearly laid out, that you've unmistakably told the citizens of this Commonwealth are the law.
To think of it as refining rather than abandon.
If you refine it in this way, you're actually reversing it, and that's a little different. If it were sanding an edge, I would agree with you. But
can this is there because one of the most frustrating parts of stare decisis is I don't think we all the time are using the right vocabulary. Stare decisis does not apply to opinions. It doesn't apply to statements. It doesn't apply to theories. It applies to holdings. The opinion, I mean, there were no opinions in the age of John Jay. It was just holdings. And in common law England, there were no opinions. It was just holdings. Stare decisis does not apply to our statements. We use statements to explain why we think the holding is what the holding is, but holdings are what bind us. Why is that lost?
Sorry to interrupt. Let me then ask you to apply the following holding. We hold that a sentence imposed in violation of a prescribed statutory range of punishment is void ab initio because the character of the judgment was not such as the court had the power to render. As I pointed out in my brief, you don't normally find dicta following words like we hold that or we announce a new rule that. This was the law that you announced. We ask that you apply it. The reason that you did it was to apprise the courts and the citizens of this Commonwealth what the law is. And it does no one any justice to say that we're now going to start creating exceptions to it. That was the court's lesson in Graf-Muller. On behalf of Ms. Porto, I greatly appreciate the time that you've given this case and the opportunity that we've had to address it today.
Thank you for taking me.
Mr. Jones, you have 1 minute, 15 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. So in Forest Lakes versus United Land Corp., it's 2017 opinion out of this court, there was a really good phrase about how assignments of error set analytical boundaries for arguments on appeal and demarc the stare decisis boundary between holdings and dicta. The issue before the court in both Rawls and Graf-Muller was what the proper remedy is for a void sentence that has been identified and reversed. The precedential value of those cases is limited to that. If the court wanted to take the statements in the case and then apply them to other contexts, that's one thing. To say that it's controlling in a different legal and factual context, such as we have here, where we have an inadequate sentence, the court doesn't need to reverse Graf-Muller and Rawls in order to find that an inadequate sentence is not in excess. And reading the whole holding in Graf-Muller that follows after that we hold language demonstrates, again, that that's consistent with what we've said, that it's a remedies case. We would just ask that the court would reverse the circuit court if there are no further questions.
Call the next case.